Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Hello, how are you going this morning?
What, today?
I always forget that we just come on to 12 o'clock.
So. It's only just gone, so it's forgivable.
Yeah, right on.
Very good today.
That's good yourself? To hear. Yeah, no, it's pretty good. The weather's a bit shocking. I always seem to talk about the weather when I first start the show. Anyway, we've got a few interesting topics for us on Dear Science today. Let's get started. I see that they haven't quite found life on Mars, but they've found something pretty interesting. Did you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so if you've you may have seen a bit more the clickbaity title of Life on Mars, but as one NASA astrobiologist put it, there's possible life on Mars billions of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And what it is basically they've found a range of minerals and organic matter that point to the ancient history of a habitable condition and potential biological processes on Mars.
Yeah, so you called this biosignatures. Yeah. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so it's basically evidence of life, evidence of biology in a biological process.
And
so,
I imagine it's not like human life, but maybe something else. A bit more.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
That's a shame.
Microbial at best, right?
yeah, right.
So basically what it is in 2020, NASA had a Mars mission that sent off the Perseverance, which is this car-sized Mars rover to Mars. Mm-hmm. It landed in February in 2021. And so as of yesterday, it's been operating for 1,670 Earth days. NASA keep very good track of these things. So it's been going for 4 years, 6 months, and 28 days. And what it's been doing is basically exploring this crater called the Jezero Crater. And this is a 45-kilometer-wide landmass or crater where they've chosen the site. They chose to land here because it had geological structures that are evidence of a past lake and river delta. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're looking for signs of life, looking for where there might have been water is a good idea.
Yeah.
So, you know, like they've directly targeted this area. And so this rover's just been cruising around for the last 4.5 years, like taking samples, doing analysis. Because what's really cool about this rover and why it's car-sized, is that it's got a lot of scientific instrumentation on it so that mm-hmm. they can actually do more study on the rock than we have been able to previously.
Yeah, sure.
And so as it's cruising around, they found this outcrop, which is just kind of a term that you use to describe a series of rocks or an area of rock kind of thing, mm-hmm. That was kind of light-toned and looked had an interesting sort of features. And so it's called Bright Angel. And basically what they were seeing was it's a thick succession of finely grained mudstone and muddy conglomerates. So conglomerates, just like collections of muddy rocks, basically.
Yeah, right.
And so what they did was, because they have all this instrumentation on board their rover, they could actually do what's called X-ray fluorescence and use UV light to do Raman and luminescence experiments. And so they could actually start to learn something about the chemistry of these rocks.
Yeah.
And so they could map the type of rocks, the distribution of the different sedimentary rocks. And so by doing this, they could first reconstruct the environment that these mudstones were probably deposited in, mm-hmm. using like the geological knowledge we've gained from Earth. And what they think is that it's probably that it was a lake deposit. So this means that it was like a lake deposit at the bottom of this river valley. So it suggests sometime in the past, you had this valley was flooded. And so you had a potentially habitable lake.
Right.
So, you know,
would it have been the same kind of water that you'd see here on Earth, or would that be different?
Yeah, no. So water.
Yeah, right.
So the fact that it would have been, you know, a lake. And mm-hmm. so that's really interesting. But then what they did was they looked at these mudstones in more detail, and what they found was there was these tiny, tiny nodules. So like on the scale of millimeters. And because they have this instrumentation on board, this rover, they could study it. And what they found was it was enriched in what's called iron phosphate or iron sulfide.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also found this organic carbon. So organic carbon is like carbon with hydrogen
around. Yeah, right.
And we've seen these sort of organic mineral soups before on Earth. And it can be like a byproduct of microbial metabolism. So
what does that mean?
So what does that mean, right? Basically, microbial poop. It's, you know, your microbes, they're eating, they're living, they leave byproduct, waste product around, and you kind of get these things. And so that's kind of like makes everyone sit up and take notice that like, oh, okay, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
You can get this mixture without it being a biological process. So abiotic, it doesn't require biology. But what they've done is they've looked at the environment around, and if it was an abiotic process, you would expect it to either involve high temperatures or a highly acidic environment. And what they're saying is the environment about doesn't really reflect this. That's why they're kind of leaning towards maybe it wasn't a biological process.
Right, okay.
But we won't really know for sure until these rocks come back to Earth and they can get studied in much more detail.
Yeah.
And that's one of the aims of the Perseverance mission was actually it's been going around, and as it's taking measurements and sending data back to Earth, it's also drilling and it's taking cores of the rock, and that's collecting them up to store them so that, you know, that they can be brought back to Earth at some point. And so it turns out that NASA and the European Space Agency are actually working on a mission to do this, bring them back to Earth in the 2030s.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe once they're back here, we'll know for sure. The scientists will be able to do their thing and figure it out for sure. But it's kind of, it's some of the best evidence so far of
that there was. That's really cool then. That sounds quite exciting. Is that saying that there could potentially be viability for it to habit?
Well,
inhabit
Mars? Yeah, see, so there's kind of...
more of a complicated story.
Yeah, so it's not a habitable environment as it is now. There'd have to be a lot done. Like, you know, like you get terraforming and all that sort of thing. There's also the idea of like, is there maybe something on there now living?
Yeah.
Again, there's a varying opinion. So you'll get astrobiologists. So astrobiologists, as the name suggests, are people who study astronomy and biology. That will say no, definitely not. But there are other people that say maybe there is and stuff. So that's kind of still an open question, and depends a little bit on the scientist you're talking to. But
yeah. definitely. Well, that's a very great story, and I can't wait to hear more about that. Hopefully in the future. We've got our next story here is glowing mammals.
What shiny
that's
mammals?
Probably a little bit more glowing. They're not quite shiny.
But actually,
like you're thinking.
Yeah, no, you can get glowing mammals, but this one's about shiny ones.
Go on.
So iridescent. So if you think of colourful animals, you're probably going to think of birds and insects, right? And they sometimes have that shimmer, that shine.
Totally.
Yeah, and that's because color in animals kind of comes from two mechanisms. It's either chemical, so you actually have a molecule that's in the feathers or in the carapace and stuff that imparts that color.
Yeah,
so that's chemical pigment. Or it's structural, so the surface of the feather or the insect shell is structured in such a way that it affects how light interacts with that surface, and then so it affects the wavelengths of light that are reflected and not reflected, and so it appears colourful.
Yeah.
So if you think of tui or kittadoo, you know, when they shimmer in the sun.
Yeah, definitely. That's the first thing I thought of when I was thinking of reading this story.
Right. And so that's this iridescence. So iridescence is just when if you change the angle of light that change the angle light hits the surface, it changes how the color of it, right?
Because that's a different thing going on to like with glowworms or fireflies something. That's totally different again.
Yeah,
because so, this is like on the fur.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this just like an evolutionary process, or how does this happen?
Yeah. So it is evolutionary. And so like in birds and insects and stuff, it can be about mate selection and looking colorful.
Yeah.
What they found here is like we used to think it wasn't really present in mammals. Like there was one mammal that we knew of, it which was this golden mole that lives underground. Basically the scientists looked at some specimens at a museum at their fur and stuff, and they found that iridescence is present in a lot more than we thought. But we don't really know why. What are they doing with it? And they actually think one of the suggestions is that it's actually a byproduct of adaptation for something else. So the iridescence in the golden mole, and likely in these other like rats and shrews that they found iridescence in, is basically in your fur, your cuticle, you have keratin, which is the protein of our hair, and it's in layers. And then between those layers is another thing, probably lipids. And so you have this alternating structure. And so that's the structure that's interfering with the light and gives you this iridescence.
Oh, cool.
What happens, though, is that makes the hair really smooth. And so these moles and these rats and stuff end up with really smooth fur, and a lot of them actually live near water or in burrows. So maybe it just means that they stay clean.
Yeah.
And okay. So the iridescence might be a consequence of trying to stay clean rather than being, I want to be shiny.
Yeah, yeah. An attractive kind of animal.
Exactly, right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting. I'll move on to our last story. It's quite an interesting one. I was having a read about how plastic waste could potentially capture carbon.
Yes.
You want to, yeah.
Yeah, no. So explain it. This one really, yeah, they really caught my eye. So this is, you know, we know there's these two major global problems of there's a lot of CO2 in our atmosphere.
Definitely.
And we have a lot of plastic waste.
Yeah,
right?
Climate change is quite a big issue at the moment, I think.
Exactly.
I think it is. You know, that's right? A terrible opinion-based assumption.
And so what this group in University of Copenhagen have done is they've actually turned plastic waste into a material that you can use to absorb CO2 out of air.
Mm.
Now, you know, like we often think of plastics, like we know we reduce, reuse, recycle, and there's another one now that I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's now this idea of, can we upcycle the waste? Can we make it do more?
Yeah.
And that? And that's what these guys have done. Like, they've basically taken polyethylene terephthalate. You're probably more familiar with it as PET plastic.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. I know what you mean.
Exactly, right? It's used in containers for your food. It's used in fiber for clothing. And you can recycle it. But actually, it represents 18% of the global plastic output, but only like 10 to 15% is actually recycled. 85 to 90% of it is either goes into landfill or gets incinerated to supply energy.
Whoa, okay.
So it's good if we can do something with this stuff, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And so what they've done is they've actually used this PET as the feed product for a reaction called aminolysis. So basically they've added an amine molecule, in this case ethylene diamine, which is relatively cheap, relatively easy to get, and it basically just breaks up the polymer chain. So it's not, it goes from being like your plastic sheet or whatever, and you get the kind of this powdery material. And what's cool about that powdery material is it can capture CO2. And it's not just, oh, it gets a little bit. It's actually on the same level as some carbon capture techniques that are showing promise already. Even better, it does it at room temperature. It doesn't require high pressure. It doesn't require
that
ultra-cold environment.
How does that make it an even better system, I suppose?
Because you don't require that energy. You don't have to put any extra energy in to make it work, right?
Okay.
So you're not burning.
So it's really efficient in how it's like fixing this problem.
Yeah, even better.
Capturing carbon.
Yeah, it also works over a wide range of temperatures. So they were, even at 150 degrees, this material was still capturing carbon.
Oh, wow.
That's really good, because if you think of an industrial process where you might be producing lots of carbon, often a lot of heat as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you want something that works over a wide temperature range.
Definitely.
And it got even better. Like, you're starting to go, did you need any more in this like paper? You can, it'll capture carbon and it'll capture as much as it can. So when it's captured as much as it can, and we say it's saturated, it can't take on any more. And then what they can do is actually put it under a heat treating process to release the carbon. And you might go, well, you just captured it. Why do you want to release it now? But what you can do is you release it, you capture that released carbon, you concentrate it, and then you can use it for things like carbonated cement fuel. And if you could show it's okay for, like, you'd probably have to do some testing in that, make sure there's no byproducts or anything, but you could even use it for your CO2 and your fizzy drinks, right?
Yeah, right.
And you can do this over and over. So they actually did some tests where they put it in flue gas conditions, so this is more like an industrial process kind of conditions, and they did 40 cycles of just letting it capture carbon and then desorption, so they were getting the carbon out, and then do it over and over again, and they did it 40 times and it was still doing a good job.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really good. That sounds like really good news for the climate solution space, I suppose.
And so the thing now is, you know, scale up. So they did it in the lab. Like, they actually took a kilo of like waste material. So they were using drinking bottles, food packaging, stuffing from soft toys, leggings and that. And they could take a kilo of this and produce their stuff. So now they're obviously got to go to like tons. Like, that's the job
definitely.
Now is
upscale
to see.
It for
exactly.
Sure. That's awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing these stories. That's really good. That's everything we've got today for Dear Science. Just before we finish up, I wanted to let our listeners know that MOTET this week from the 13th, which is over the weekend, to the 21st of September, you can celebrate Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori at MOTAT with a week full of playful, creative, and hands-on experiences for tamariki and whānau. Very exciting stuff, so get down there if you've got the time. Thank you again, Krishla, for joining us on the show today. Thank you to MOTAT, and thank you, Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.